Bibles then to 2 Samuel. We have to finish up what we started last week because we got into deceitful servants and disgraceful sons. Deceitful servants cursing opponents and disgraceful sons. And we covered the first two items. We didn't cover the last one. And so we're going to finish up with that before we move on to the following section, Appeal to Vanity Saves the Day. So we've left David off. This is where the TV show says last time on the Chronicles of David. And it shows you the brief little pictures that explain absolutely nothing. Yeah, if you've seen those shows and you come in the second week of a To Be Continued and you watch those short little clips, if you hadn't seen the first week, you'd never know anything that's going on. I think they're more confusing just watching those short little introductory clips. But David is on the run again because his son Absalom has aspirations to the throne. He's decided he doesn't want to wait for David to pass away. Probably he also knows at this point that he is not the favored son anymore. Who's the favored son? Solomon. We traced out a little bit last time and reasoned that Solomon is probably only 12 or 13 years old at this point. We are within 7 or 8 years of the end of David's life, and Solomon is not a full-grown man yet. Even when he takes the throne upon David's death, we're told he's a young man, very inexperienced. And so it's one of the reasons he prays to the Lord for wisdom. So one of the few kings, actually, that we don't have an age for when he begins or when he ends. Well, all we know is that Solomon reigned for 40 years. Other than that, we don't know how old he was when he started. We don't know how old he was when he died. Scripture never tells us. I guess that's one of those things, Deuteronomy 29, the secret things belong to the Lord, but the things that are revealed belong to us and to our children. God decided not to tell us. So apparently, Solomon's age isn't all that important in the course of life, right? But there it is. So David is on the run because Absalom is taking things into his own hands. And so David is marching out of Jerusalem. We noted that he trekked all the way from Jerusalem down the valley into the Jordan River Valley, which is a very steep descent, very rough road, about 20 miles, and he parked himself there at the Jordan River to refresh him and his crew of people. All along the way, he was being taunted and cursed at by a man of the family of Saul, a Benjaminite, whose name was Shimei, threw stones at David and yelled at him and accused David of being the one to kill all of Saul's household. But then he was also met by Ziba, the servant of Mephibosheth. Mephibosheth has been living in David's house for nigh on to 20 years now, eating at David's table as a son. And Ziba gives David some bad news. Mephibosheth thinks that this is a grand opportunity for he and Saul's house to regain the dynasties in Israel. And so Mephibosheth didn't come with him to follow David. Now, Mephibosheth is lame, so he probably couldn't have followed David anyway. But that's what we've got from Ziba. So David is leaving the scene in a very dejected, very depressed, very discouraged situation. It seems like enemies all around him and very few people supporting him. So the scene goes back to Jerusalem. We leave David marching through the wilderness and we come back to Jerusalem. Verse 15. Now Absalom and all the people, the men of Israel, came to Jerusalem. And Ahithophel was with him. Why does it note specifically that Ahithophel was with him? Who is Ahithophel? I'll test your memories. This is your midterm exam. He is an advisor, yes. He was one of David's most trusted advisors. And so that's a blow to have Ahithophel on Absalom's side. David knows that Ahithophel's counsel is good counsel. It produces good results. Who else is Ahithophel? This is Bathsheba's grandfather. Okay, that makes the blow all the worse. And we said, maybe there's a little bit of family issues going on there too, that Ahithophel wants to side with Absalom against David. But Ahithophel being with Absalom is of importance because of what's going to follow. Now, David knew that Ahithophel was with Absalom, and so David sent back into the city another good friend, good counselor of his, named Hushai the Archite. These names are tough to keep into memory because they don't sound like normal run-of-the-mill names here from the 21st century. We don't have like John and Ben and Bob. Yeah, Bob. I don't know. What's normal names? Yeah, I never liked the name Brian when I was growing up. I always thought Brian's a kid's name, and when I grow up, I'm just going to sound like I'm a kid all the time. And now here I am growing up, and I still have Brian. Yeah. Nobody changed my name, anyhow. I'd have to change my my email address and everything. Verse 16, when Hushai the Archite, David's friend, came to Absalom, Hushai said to Absalom, long live the king, long live the king. Remember, David sent Hushai back into the city to function as a spy. And so when he meets Absalom, he's putting on a very good show and making professions of allegiance to Absalom. Well, Absalom is not near so quick to trust him. Verse 17, Absalom said to Hushai, is this your loyalty to your friend? Why did you not go with your friend? What are you doing here, Hushai? You were David's good friend. I understand why Ahithophel's with me, whatever that reason is. Whether he's mad at David for the affair with Bathsheba or whatever, Ahithophel, Absalom understands. But he says to Hushai, what are you doing here? You're one of David's friends. You should be with him. And so Hushai said to Absalom, no. For whom the Lord and this people and all the men of Israel have chosen, his I will be, and with him I will remain. And again, whom should I serve? Should it not be his son? As I have served your father, so I will serve you. Basically, what Hushai tells him is, I want to be on the winning side. You know, whoever the Lord picks and whoever all the people are picked, that's the one I'm going to stay with. Now, this is a good politician speech, isn't it? We just got to get behind the candidate and support him. And if you can't do that, you're not loyal. Well, Hushai's playing that card very well and saying, no. I'm with whoever the people and the Lord want. And apparently, Absalom, that's you, because look, you got this huge army. David just marched out of town, and he only had about 600 or 700 people with him, so that's small potatoes. You've got the whole army. You've got the entire nation behind you, so nope, I'm with you. And if I was loyal to your father throughout his whole life, then guess what? I'll be loyal to you as well. Would anybody ever buy that kind of statement? Yes, we do it all the time. Go ahead, Gene. Yes, we do. Yeah. It always, I don't want to say cracked me up because it's kind of sad, but when a person would leave one marriage for another relationship and girl A would say, or girl B would say, oh, he'll be faithful to me his whole life. You just have evidence to the contrary. What makes you think that what he did to this one, he's not going to do to this one? But, no, he'd never do that to me. He just did that to her because, you know, this and this and this. We believe our own lies, don't we? Hushai is playing to Absalom here. He's professing his loyalty in not very devoted terms, but in terms that convince Absalom. And he's going to continue to do that throughout his time with Absalom. And so, Absalom believes it. Verse 20, Absalom said to Ahithophel, give your counsel, what should we do? So, they've come into the city, they have taken Jerusalem without a battle, David and all of his supporters are gone, so Absalom now has control of the royal city and de facto control of the entire country. This coup has succeeded, and now he's got the capital. But the hearts of all the people are not necessarily with him because there's this little problem still floating around out there, and that's David's still alive. And there might be some people still loyal to David. And he does have 600 at least, probably closer to 750 or 1,000, mighty people wandering off with him. That's a problem. We don't want them harassing us as we try to establish our new kingdom. So how do we cement power? That was always the question when there was a changeover of a dynasty in the ancient world. How do I cement control? What form did it usually take? Kill off everybody related to the previous royal dynasty. And a lot of times what they liked to do too was erase any mention of the previous dynasty from the records. When we look at the Egyptian monuments, all of the pyramids and all of the temples that they left us and the obelisks and things, we find out very frequently that they have erased names from the histories and put in new names. And so a new pharaoh would come on the scene, and he didn't like the old pharaoh, so he would have his servants go throughout the whole kingdom and erase any reference to the previous pharaoh from all of the inscriptions. And he would put his name on them. And that's how they tried to seal the power for themselves. It's called changing the history books, right? You try and alter history as it's perceived, because if you control what people know to be true, you control how they think. Satan has known this from the very beginning. It's why he's constantly trying to get us to believe the lie and to believe what isn't true. And so, know what's true. Cling to it. Well, here's Ahithophel's counsel. How are we going to cement power to Absalom? Verse 21, Ahithophel said to Absalom, "Go into your father's concubines, who he has left to keep the house, and all Israel will hear that you have made yourself a stench to your father, and the hands of all who are with you will be strengthened." Boy, there's nothing like a no-return situation to really cement your zeal, is there? Here's Ahithophel's advice. Take this action, the 10 concubines that David left behind to keep the royal palace, sweep the floors, mop, you know, clean the windows, all that stuff. He left them there, and Ahithophel says, "Absalom, you need to marry them." That was also a very common means of claiming the throne. You erase the history books, you claim the royal harem for yourself, and you kill off anybody that might challenge you. It's a good way to cement power for yourself, okay? And so that's Ahithophel's advice. You're going to go in, you're going to marry these girls, and that is going to show all of Israel that you are so committed to this, there is no going back. Because really, at that point, how many people could come, "Oh, Dad, I'm really sorry, I shouldn't have done that. Will you forgive me?" Okay. Not going to happen. Not going to happen. And so this is all a means to make things a no-return situation, to make it so there's no possible way of going back. And he says, that's going to strengthen the hands of all who are with you. So all of the army that's accompanying Absalom come into Jerusalem. When they see this event take place, they know there's no going back. Now they're going to fight all the harder, knowing that there's no possible way to return from this. Say, we're with Absalom, and he's doing that. Okay, we better fight pretty hard. All right. So, verse 22, they pitched a tent for Absalom on the roof. We're not just going to do this in the secret places of the palace. We're going to do this on the roof in the sight of the public. And Absalom went into his father's concubines in the sight of all Israel. This is blatant. This is very purposeful. And this is disgraceful. Absalom should have known that even if this was a commonly accepted practice among the kings of the ancient Near East, it was forbidden by Jehovah. This was a disgraceful thing. There were other people in history that have done this. If we think back to Reuben, Israel's firstborn, he did the same thing. It says he went up to his father's couch, he slept with one of his father's concubines, and he was cursed for it. And the right of the firstborn was removed from him. When Israel was on his deathbed and blessing his children, he removed the blessing of the firstborn from Reuben for that act and transferred it. So what does Absalom think he's going to gain by this? You know what he thinks he's going to gain? He's accepted the stinking thinking of the world. This is one of those examples of worldliness encroaching upon God's people. He's lived in Geshur for so long, and he's been living like a pagan in his grandfather's house, and he's accepted that this is just how it's done. This is how we do things. This is what works. And so when the advice comes along, he says, that sounds like a good idea to me. And he goes along with it. Instead of countering all of that pagan thinking with his knowledge of God's law. We know God's law restores the soul, renews the soul. It's a guide to us. It's a lamp to our feet, a light to our path. Tells us where to step. tells us what decisions are good ones and what decisions aren't good ones. And so if we're not constantly burying our nose in God's word, we're going to be influenced by the thinking of the world around us, and it's not always good. Now, there was a time in American history when the culture around us was a basically Christian culture. And even somebody that wasn't an avid, devoted Christian, their advice may line up with what God said simply because the word pervaded everything. It's not the way it is anymore, is it? Especially get into the cities. I mean, we're a little bit shielded out here in the rural areas, aren't we? There's still a high percentage of people that go to church and at least are hearing something of the Word of God on a regular basis, but it's just not that way in most of the world. And so if you get out there in it, you're going to accept all that stinking thinking because you're just surrounded by it all the time. There's that old adage that if you tell somebody a lie long enough, they'll believe it. Well, that's why you've got to constantly be countering the lie with the truth. I said, did God say that? No, he didn't. Well, then I have to ignore what you're telling me because it's not true. Well, Satan's not going to give up on us that easy, is he? He's going to keep bombarding us with the lie, always from different directions. Why do you think your email inbox fills up so fast? And you got to go through and just click delete all, and you can't even read it all. There's messages coming from everywhere. There's commercials on TV and radio and emails and what else? Who knows? I mean, you can't even open your Yahoo account without all kinds of thousands of commercials going on around your news or the emails you get. And Satan bombards us with it, and in Absalom's case, it worked. He accepts this horribly wicked advice and proves himself to be a disgraceful son. Not a son who honored the law the way David did. We understand, again, about David. We've referenced this many times. He's not a perfect man, but he was a man after God's own heart. He followed God's law. Most of the time, he did what God told him to do. But unfortunately, he failed in training his sons how to do the same thing, and now he's seeing the results of that. Now, in those days, the counsel that Ahithophel gave was as if one consulted the word of God. So was all the counsel of Ahithophel esteemed, both by David and by Absalom. There's why they both want this man. His counsel was always good, except now he's taken a very dark path. And it's going to turn very quickly upon him. He's using all of that ability of persuasion that God gave him now to effect a wicked end. Not only the rebellion of a son against his father, but also in some of the gross, immoral happenings that Absalom is undertaking here. And so Ahithophel, though he used to be a very good counselor, he possesses still all of those qualities of persuasion, all of those seemingly good reasonings, and yet he's become devoid of godly counsel. And he's steering Absalom down the path of unrighteousness. And so we get to chapter 17. We've seen disgrace or deceitful servants, cursing opponents, and disgraceful sons. Now we're going to see how an appeal to vanity saves the day. An appeal to vanity saves the day, chapter 17. Moreover, that tells us there's a little bit more. Okay, the story is continuing. So the saga that we left in 16, this is just a continuation of it. We've had a commercial break, but we're back to it now. Moreover, Ahithophel said to Absalom, "Let me choose 12,000 men. And I will arise and pursue David tonight. I will come upon him while he is weary and discouraged and throw him into a panic. And all the people who are with him will flee. And I will strike down only the king. And I will bring back all the people to you as a bride comes home to her husband. You seek the life of only one man, and all the people will be at peace." And the advice seemed right in the eyes of Absalom and the eyes of the elders of Israel. So here's Ahithophel once again using his powers of persuasion and counsel. But I'm going to read this section again, and I want you to pay attention to what he's saying, because this whole narrative now hinges on the difference between this advice and the advice that Absalom's going to get from Hushai. Okay? So as we go through here, we're going to note a few things. Let who choose 12,000 men? Me. Okay, just notice that, right? Obviously, I think it's important, or I wouldn't tell you to notice it. But sometimes two little letters can be extremely important. Let me choose. How many? Why 12,000? Why not the whole army? Well, David doesn't have more men. 12,000 would be completely sufficient. What's that? 12,000 maybe that want to that favor Absalom, okay? How quick would it be to gather all the army? It'd take a while. It takes several days, maybe a week, to gather the entire army. How long could it take him to get 12,000? He might have them with him. Remember, he went down to Hebron, blew the trumpet throughout all Israel. He might already have 12,000 people marching with him. So there the argument is, let me pick 12,000. They're going to be chosen men. This isn't calling up the militia. These are our best guys, and we're going to pick 12,000 because it's faster. And he's going to continue on that speed theme. And so let me choose 12,000 men, and I will arise and pursue David when? Tonight. Let's get this thing done. So here's our timeline. You're down in Hebron. Absalom blows the trumpet, right? And he starts marching to Jerusalem. That's, you could do it in 3/4 of a day or so. March up to Jerusalem. As he's coming up to Jerusalem, David leaves Jerusalem and starts fleeing. So David is barely crested over the Mount of Olives on the east side of Jerusalem when Absalom gets into Jerusalem. Ahithophel knows David's not more than 5 or 6 miles away at this point. So speed is very necessary. We get these 12,000 guys. Let's go get him now. Let's end this thing now. So this also tells us that probably the events of the last part of chapter 16 haven't taken place yet. Ahithophel has counseled it, go in and marry your father's concubines. Take the royal harem to yourself. But that probably hasn't happened just yet. Because it's still daylight, Absalom's still making preparations, and so this is all Hushai's advice. So first thing I want you to do, Absalom, claim the royal harem for yourself. Secondly, while you're doing that, let me take 12,000 men, and I'll go and I'll get David tonight. We'll do this quickly. Verse 2, first word, I will come upon him while he is weary and discouraged and throw him into a panic. So, obviously, what I'm wanting you to note is who does Ahithophel say gets to do all this? He does. Yeah, he does. That's going to be important. Now, at first, we've already read at the end, what does Absalom think of this advice? He likes it. And all the elders of Israel say, yeah, this is the way to go. But it's going to be important when Hushai gives his counter-counsel. So I want you to note this. Ahithophel is plainly placing himself at the lead of the armies and as the one that's going to go get David. Here again we see there might be a very intense personal grudge between Ahithophel and David because he wants to be the one to go get him. Now, second thing, the second element of this advice, what condition is he convincing Absalom that David and his men are in? What's that? Bad condition. Yeah, look at how he describes them. They're weary and discouraged and will throw him into a panic, and all the people who are with him will flee. When, at any point in David's life, did he and his men ever break from a battle and run? Never. It's never happened. I mean, this is the guy that went to face the giant Goliath all by himself. This is the guy that summoned his 600 troops and went to save Keilah, the city of Keilah, when the Philistines were invading. This is not a guy that just breaks and runs from a battle. So Hushai is trying to paint David as if he's in such a discouraged state that he'll just break and flee. Is David discouraged at this point? Oh, yeah. Yeah, you better believe he is. But as we talked about last time, David learned through all his years of running from Saul that sometimes the only thing you can do is just keep putting one foot in front of the other. You might not know what's 10 steps ahead, but God will let you know what's one step in front of you. That's why he promises in his word to make his word a lamp to our feet. So I might not be able to see what's at the end of the hallway, but God is letting me see what's right in front of me, and I know what I need to do right now. And so for David, we got to get to the fords of the Jordan. That's our next goal. From there, I have no idea. We'll make those plans. We'll cross that bridge when we get there. But Ahithophel is trying to paint David as if he's in this very discouraged state of mind and that he can be easily conquered. That's another key element that he's throwing into this council. David can be easily conquered and quickly conquered. All right. So, throw him into a panic and all the people who are with him will flee. And then, I will. What's he say next? I will. Strike down who? The king only. So here's the plan. 12,000 men are going to descend upon 700, 800 discouraged people, and we'll take them by surprise. Everybody will flee, and we will only kill David. Wayne, you're shaking your head. You don't believe that's going to happen? No, probably not. That's probably... As he's got a what? I'm sorry?
A good, strong rear guard.
Yes, he has a good, strong rear guard. Yeah, these 12,000 men aren't going to get anywhere near David. But it sounds good, doesn't it? Quick defeat? This was what Hitler was telling people all throughout Germany. We'll just march through there. And he proved he could do it with Poland and then France. And then he said the same thing's going to happen in Russia. Oh, yeah, we'll just go in. We'll stomp right through them. Blitzkrieg. We'll take it over. We'll own the whole world. England, same thing. We'll get them all. Didn't quite go that way, did it? But that was the message. Quick, easy defeat. Pumps people up. It makes your people think that there's no way we can decline this kind of advice. It's going to be quick. It's going to be easy. And yeah, why wouldn't we do that? I'll strike down only the king. There's another reason he's going to say, I'm going to only strike down only the king. Because he continues in verse 3, I will bring back all the people to you as a bride comes home to her husband. How does a bride come home to her husband? Probably met with gifts. Yeah. We could ask the ladies. Ladies, if your husband had been gone for a couple of days and he came home, were you excited to have him come home? And don't shake your head no. If you weren't excited, we don't want to know about it. Yes, they'd be excited, right? As a bride comes home to her husband. It's that picture of joy. And here's what Ahithophel is saying. These people aren't really with David. When he's gone, their hearts will turn to you like a bride to her husband, and they'll all be ready and willing to come back to Jerusalem and swear their allegiance. Gene? Oh, what's the NAS say there? Oh. Isn't that interesting? Oh, here we go. Back to you, like the return of the whole man is whom you seek. The idea there is the same. I'll have to look into that little linguistic difference. The idea is the same either way, that the people will come back. They'll all come back to you once David's gone. David's the instigator here. He's the only reason people are following him is because it's him. He's kind of a big name, but once he's out of the picture, everybody will be coming back. Okay. And so... Here, they'll all come back to you. You seek the life of only one man, and all the people will be at peace. Oh, doesn't peace in our time sound good? Trouble is, there's a peace that's to be known only on the other side of war, isn't there? Sometimes you have to fight. We'd all like to be at peace all the time. But peace has to be maintained. Well, Ahithophel is promising a quick, easy victory. And a long peace afterwards. And that is advice that Absalom and the people like. So the advice seemed right in the eyes of Absalom and all the elders of Israel. However, Absalom has two resources at his disposal. Ahithophel has just given his advice, but now he has this newly proclaimed advisor, Hushai. who has not been in the war council up to this point, but Absalom has an idea. Call Hushai the Archite also, and let us hear what he has to say. So he knows that Hushai has good advice. That's why David kept him around and was such good friends with him. So let's hear what he has to say. And when Hushai came to Absalom, Absalom said to him, "Thus has Ahithophel spoken. Shall we do as he says? If not, you speak." So he lays out Ahithophel's plan, and now Hushai is going to argue his side. Now remember, Hushai is there to try and counter Ahithophel's advice and to report to David what's going on. He's functioning as a spy. So his first order of business, obviously he can't go get a message out right now, can't turn around on his iPhone and send a quick email or text message to David. By the way, I'm in the royal chamber and here's what they're saying, right? So he has to, first of all, defeat Ahithophel's counsel. That's order number one. So Hushai said to Absalom, "This time the counsel that Ahithophel has given is not good." I love how he attacks this, because he doesn't come out and lambast Ahithophel as a person, does he? He doesn't attack his character. He doesn't attack his motivation. He doesn't attack anything about him. He just says, well, this advice isn't good. They always tell you, if you do have to criticize somebody, be careful. Don't criticize their person, right? You can criticize what they said, and I even love when Job's wife comes to him and says, just curse God and die. And he doesn't come right out and say, you fool, how can you say that? You remember what he says? You speak as one of the foolish women. So you're talking like one of the foolish women, but he doesn't accuse her directly. Okay? And so this is the tactic that Hushai is going to take. This time, not all times, this time the counsel that Ahithophel has given is not good. Hushai said, here's why it's not good. Well, he didn't say that. I'm filling that in here. Hushai said, you know that your father and his men are mighty men, and that they are enraged like a bear robbed of her cubs in the field. Which part of Ahithophel's advice is he countering? Yeah, the weak, dispirited will flee at the drop of a pin idea, right? Hushai says, no, you know that your father's not like that. Come on, Absalom. They are mighty men. These are men that have seen battle. They have faced the worst that life has to offer, and they've come through it. They're not going to break up easily. And on top of that, they are mad. They're mad. They're enraged. They're bitter of soul. He says, look, you just kicked them out of their house. You're trying to steal his throne. Don't think that David's going to sit down and take that lightly. Even though it's his son, yes, he's discouraged, yes, he's despondent, but I can guarantee you he's mad. Have you ever fought with somebody that's mad? It's crazy, right? I mean, the things that come flying, fists and feet and spit and words and all kinds of stuff. So, yeah, he says this is not going to be as easy as Ahithophel makes it sound, because they're not dispirited, they're angry. They're like a bear robbed of her cubs in the field. Besides, your father is an expert in war. He will not spend the night with the people. Behold, even now he has hidden himself in one of the pits or in some other place. So, which part of Ahithophel's counsel is he debunking now? Yeah, the speed with which you'll be able to do this. You're not going to find him tonight. Don't you remember, Absalom, when you were little and your dad told you all those stories of the time he was fleeing from Saul? He didn't camp in the open field, did he? He slept in the caves. He slept in the forests. He found places to hide. Your dad's not an idiot. We need more kids to hear that message, don't we? Dad actually knows what he's talking about sometimes. But in this case, he's an expert in war. He's not going to spend the night. You're not going to be able to descend on him with this quick raiding party and find him. He says, even now, he's hidden. He's hidden himself in one of the pits or some other place. He's gone already. This is not going to be fast. You're not going to be able to find him tonight. And as soon as some of the people fall at the first attack, whoever hears it will say, there's been a slaughter among the people who follow Absalom. Then even the valiant man whose heart is like the heart of a lion will utterly melt with fear, for all Israel knows that your father is a mighty man and that those who are with him are valiant men. Which part's he debunking here? Yeah, that they'll all return. That whole thing about them returning as a bride or returning as one man. No, you don't understand. As soon as some of your men die in battle, and they're going to, you're going to put these men in harm's way because this bear cub, or this she-bear robbed of her cubs, is going to fight fiercely. Even though they're only 600 men, even if you go up against them with 12,000, the first few of your men that fall dead are going to scare the rest of your people. The insinuation there being, look, Absalom, your dad has the valiant men of Israel, the mighty men of Israel, the leaders of the army are with David, and we're calling up the militia. Militia is a great thing, but they often break in battle very quickly because they're not trained. They haven't experienced much war. They don't know how to stand when the bullets and, well, I guess not bullets in this era, huh? When the arrows are flying past their head and the swords are cutting them open. They run because they're scared. And so he says, as soon as the first few people fall down, even the valiant men that are with you are going to break and they're going to flee. So contrary to it being David's men that are going to run and flee, Absalom, it's going to be your guys, and you know it, because David's too strong for this. I think he's also challenging the idea that he'll be able to bring back, or to only kill the king and bring everybody else back. So that you're that's wishful thinking, Absalom. There's no way you're going to be able to attack and only kill the king, because these guys are going to fight fiercely, and it's going to cost you a lot of your own men's lives to get David. Verse 11, but. So that first section, he has been debunking Ahithophel's advice. It's not going to be quick. It's not going to be easy. You're not going to only kill one man. You're going to lose a lot of men in this endeavor. And the people that are with David are not going to be easily swayed. So here's the advice I've got. Verse 11. My counsel is that how many men be gathered? All of them. Blow the trumpet. Gather the militia. Get everybody in Israel here to Jerusalem. Get them organized. Why do you think Hushai is calling for this measure? Time. This gives David time to escape, doesn't it? Because even Hushai just left David. Remember, he was up on the top of the Mount of Olives and David sent him back. And as soon as he got into the city, Absalom came in. So he knows David's only a couple hours away. So I can imagine poor Hushai inside, he's probably just like tremoring. He's so scared for his friend David. But on the outside, he's got to act calm. Oh, no, just call the whole army together. Yeah, it'll take a few days, but it'll be okay. We'll catch him. Don't worry. Please, please, please. All Israel be gathered. To whom? To you. You notice the change in pronouns here? Who was Ahithophel wanting to gather everybody to? Himself. Here's where this appeal to vanity comes in. You want to convince a wicked person to do something? Just make it seem like it's really good for them. Because let's face it, we're at heart all self-loving sinners. And we love to hear about things going well for us, don't we? So the best way to convince a self-loving sinner that you're right is to promise him that this is going to be good for him. So, Absalom, let everybody be gathered to you from Dan to Beersheba. Dan is the tribe and a city that was way up in the north of Israel, Beersheba way in the south. Gather them all. Get them all gathered to you as the sand by the sea for multitude. Don't you love that picture? How many sands are on the seashore? I've seen the number calculated, and it wouldn't fit on my calculator. So, if it's more than about four digits, I can't keep it in my brain. But all right, sand by the seashore for multitude, and that you go into battle in person. Why is he presenting this measure? Oh, there might be a little hope that if Absalom goes into the battle, he gets killed, right? I mean, that would be one of it. What's Absalom hearing when he hears this? And you go into battle in person. Conquering glory, yes. Oh, yeah. Why do you think so many guys sit around playing Call of Duty and all these warrior games? Because we have this image of ourselves that we're mighty warriors. Like, yeah, I can take him. Oh, this will be great. Weapons in hand. Oh, we men love our weapons. We love knives and guns and stuff, don't we? We like explosions. That's why when the girls go to movies, they go to romance in the movies. And when the guys go to movies, they go to laser blasters and spaceships and exploding things. Yeah, it's just men and women. It's basic nature, right? He's appealing to his manly vanity. You be the one marching at the head of this army. And so Absalom's got this picture of himself, all decked out in the royal army and thousands upon thousands of troops at his command. Oh, yeah, that sounds great. Now he's winning him over with this. You go into battle in person, so we shall come upon him in some place where he is to be found. Notice he's not going to say where, because he's already said, he's gone. We got to search him out. We don't know where he is, but it's going to take time. So we'll find him wherever he is, and we shall light upon him as the dew falls on the ground. What is this picture all about? Conquering, yeah. We have had a lot of humidity in the last few weeks, and every morning I go out, everything's soaked, right? That dew is everywhere. You put something outside, what keeps it from getting covered in dew if it's outside? Nothing. You got to cover it, right? If you don't want dew on it, you better cover it up. But if it's outside, it's going to have dew on it. And that's that picture that we're just completely unstoppable with you at the helm and this force of all the Israelites at your back. We're going to fall upon him like the dew. There won't be anywhere he can hide. He's going to get covered by us. And you just have to picture these swarms of men charging over the hillsides of Israel and just rooting out everything. And all the men with him, not one will be left. What's that picture? Nobody of David's team will be left. Complete, total destruction. We will wipe them out. He's appealing to that sense of complete conquering that he knows Absalom has. Verse 13, here's some great picturesque language. This stuff should be straight out of the book How to Win Friends and Influence People. If he withdraws into a city, then all Israel will bring ropes to that city, and we shall drag it into the valley until not even a pebble is to be found there. I mean, can you just see them wrapping ropes around the city wall and dragging it into the valley? Isn't that a hilarious picture? But it's profoundly vain, isn't it? Nothing will be able to stop us. Absalom, here's how powerful we are. And so wherever he goes, it doesn't matter. He can run, but he can't hide. But we will find him. We will root him out. And even if he's protected by city walls, we'll just drag the whole city into the valley. As if we were members of some kid's fairy tale, right? Paul Bunyan and his big blue ox. We'll just carve out new valleys and things. And if we fill up one valley with cities, we'll dig another one ourselves. And then we'll fill that valley up too. So here's that picturesque language. So it works. Verse 14, Absalom and all the men of Israel said, the counsel of Hushai the Archite is better than the counsel of Ahithophel. Next statement, very important. Was it primarily because Hushai is a better argumenter than Ahithophel? Was it because Hushai's advice was necessarily better? I mean, just weighing the two options, which one do you think would work? Probably the first one. You descend on him right away, and yeah, you're probably going to take him. You're going to lose a few men, but you're going to take him. Hushai effectively delays action so that David can get away. And the reason that his advice sounded better, because the Lord had ordained to defeat the good counsel of Ahithophel, so that the Lord might bring harm upon Absalom. Here's our statement in this narrative. And often the people chronicling this for us give us God's perspective on the histories that we're looking at. Here's God's perspective. Whose side is God on? David. He's on David's side. At some points, it doesn't quite look like it, does it? I mean, David's the one fleeing. David's the one just got kicked out of his house. David's the one questioning whether or not God actually is on his side. But he is. And so in this battle between father and son, we have a clear statement inspired by the Holy Spirit, written down for us in the pages of these Chronicles. God's got a plan for Absalom. And it's not a plan to prosper him and bring him to a good end, is it? Because you don't violate God's law like this. What's the promise attached to the fifth commandment? Honor your father and mother, that your days may be long in the land that the Lord your God is giving you. How old's Absalom? Early 30s. Not a very long life. And already we have a statement that God's intention is to bring harm upon him, probably in a big degree because he's violating this commandment. He's bringing dishonor upon his father. So, Hushai knew how to appeal to Absalom's vanity, and it saved the day. Action is delayed because God moved among Absalom and his counselors to agree with Hushai's advice rather than Ahithophel's, and David is saved. Any questions?